Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. I'm joined by the only occasionally present commissioning editor, cheese lover and ambler, Thea Lenarduzzi.
Hello.
Hello, thank you for postponing. Actually, I'm not laughing about your holidays, but there is one coming up, isn't there?
I'm here next week and then I am away. But so are you.
So am I. So what are we going to do? Shall we cancel the podcast, Thea?
I don't know. No, probably not.
We're probably not going to. So
show goes on.
Yeah, so friends of the podcast, Lucy Dallas, the token Northerner who occasionally reads the paper, the other token Northerner, and Toby Lishtig, the Emma McBride fanboy.
Fun fanboy.
I mean, they probably are known by other names and for other things, but that's how I associate them. We'll be doing this show, so you have one more week of us, and then you get a merciful break from us. If you want to subscribe to the TLS, Google TLS subscriptions, type pod 1 in the offer code section and get 6 issues for £6. Coming up on the show, we're going to devote the entire programme to the wonderful and luminous figure that is Jane Austen, who died 200 years ago this week. To commemorate the bicentennial, the TLS has published a special book containing the best writing in the paper about Jane Austen over the last 100 years. It's got plenty of modern criticism alongside original articles by Virginia Woolf and E.M. Forster. If you want to buy it for the Janeite in your life, just go to Amazon and search TLS and Jane Austen. The paper this week is also an Austen fest. We've asked a group of writers and thinkers to define their relationship with Austen. Ian Sansom has reread all 6 of the novels and tried to examine them afresh, and Charlotte and Gwendolyn Mitchell have answered this all too familiar question. Did Joshua Reynolds paint a portrait of Jane Austen's aunt? The answer, if I may resort to the idiom of clickbait for a moment, will amaze you. Do you know the answer to that question yet?
I can't say it, otherwise...
No, just ruin it for everyone, yeah. It's just ruin it. You can't give it away. That's the whole,
you have to click through.
Yeah, exactly. It's the whole opposite of clickbait if you give the answer. Contributing to our Austen Symposium and joining us in the studio to discuss all things Austen is writer and critic Claire Harmon. We were going to have the commissioning editor responsible for all things 18th century, the only century that matters to him, actually, at the TLS, Michael the Dr. Keynes, but ironically, given his nickname, he is unwell at the moment. So we will do this in his honour, but without him. Jane Austen was born in 1775 in a small village in Hampshire, the 7th of 8 children. She belongs to that small pantheon of great writers who remain both effortlessly fresh and engaging while still endlessly subject to pastiche. There are zombie versions of Austen novels. There are, as Devonie Lozer informed us on this podcast in January, pornographic versions of her novels. Indeed, it's hard to conceive of another great author, not Dickens, not Eliot, not James, capable of sustaining such a broad response. What's the reason for it? Well, part, it must be the quality of the writing, the acuity of the vision, the universality of the themes, money, pride, love, disappointment, expectation, the confinement of our chance existence. There's also the fact that the brilliance of her output was never allowed to be obscured, as in the case of so many writers, by an indulgent late period or an experimental middle phase. No, she wrote 6 beautiful, important novels published in a period of 7 years. The last, Persuasion, in 1818, arguably even better than the first, Sense and Sensibility, in 1811. There are no duds, no excrescences, no failures. Famously, the Oxford philosopher Gilbert Ryle was once asked whether he ever read novels. Yes, he asserted, all 6 every year. His reaction is representative of many. Austen will always have her fervent votaries, her impassioned supporters. Ask your acquaintances to rank the 6 novels in order of preference, and you'll guarantee yourself a pleasing half hour of robust fireside debate, just as if you were happily ensconced at Pemberley or Hartfield. We may try that in this podcast. We're all Janeites now, notes Ian Sansom in the TLS this week, and if you're not, look out. To commemorate the bicentennial of her death, we have devoted a paper, book and this podcast to consider what is it that makes Austen so special and so alive in the modern world. Well, to help us do that, we're delighted to welcome writer and critic Claire Harmon. Claire, thank you for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
Let's try and start generally and then focus it in. As this bicentennial happens, what do we need to know about Austen? What are people celebrating, do you think, this week?
Well, it's a good question, isn't it? Because it's actually the death that is the anniversary.
Yeah.
And I'm old enough to remember the bicentenary of her birth in 1975.
Ah.
And it was quite quietly celebrated. I mean, there were some stamps, and I can't remember anything else happening at all. I mean, there might have been a few newspaper articles. But, I mean, there's a blizzard of Austen material now, and there has been since 2011, when the bicentenary of the first of her novels to be published came out, and so that's Sense and Sensibility. And really, there's no escape. So it does make one wonder what's being celebrated. I mean, she's obviously a national treasure. She is one of the most recognisable names, silhouettes. It's not probably her, but we recognise it as Jane Austen. She's become such a smoothly handled and pass onable cultural coin that people just can't resist passing it around, celebrating her, and using her.
Is it because is she an easy read in a way that perhaps certainly Henry James isn't? Eliot probably isn't. Dickens has his moments, but there's a lot of bustle and there's lots of excrescences in Dickens, and Jane Austen feels somehow sort of perfectly simple and elegant.
Yes, she is simple, isn't she? I mean, there's nothing you couldn't give to an O-level or GCSE student. And I certainly read Austen as a teenager and found her puzzling because I didn't find her funny, but she certainly wasn't difficult to read. I mean, she was easy to read. And the love stories are what hit you first, aren't they? And they can be read on so many different levels. She's celebrated as an ironist of unplumbable depths. And yet you can also just sit down and have a very nice convalescent, feet by the fire kind of thing. Or with the films, which is what I do when I'm feeling ill. I want to put on a video of, Pride and Prejudice or DVD. And if I'm on a plane, stress situation, I'll go for the Jane Austen adaptation because she's just very comforting at one level. Plus, if you go to the novels and want to have a really sort of perplexing half hour puzzling over the morality of what Edward Ferrars does and Eleanor Dashwood, you can do that too. I mean, there's no end to that. But the language is very, very simple and the descriptions are sparse.
It's interesting in that respect because someone who is often compared to Jane Austen is Elena Ferrante. And in fact,
really?
She wrote, yes, Ferrante wrote an introduction to a beautiful folio edition a year or two ago, a new edition of Sense and Sensibility, I think it was. And it's interesting as well, because when people talk about Ferrante, they talk about this thing of being able to read her on a complex level or on a superficial level, a more superficial level, let's say, where you can skim read and pick up, the narrative, the plot, without having to go into the minutiae of it all. And that's, I think it's Ian Sampson in the piece that he's written for us, really mentions how you can skim read Austen, and most people do probably on their first readings, which makes it well suited to
school. Or on their repeat readings.
Where
you just, where you are. I mean, I guiltily admit to reading Pride and Prejudice every year, more or less.
Gilbert Ryle de nos jours.
Yeah, I know, I'm sorry about that.
Do you go for the bits specifically that you know, do you skim to get to the bits that you know you really enjoy? Or do
I read for the telltale compression of pages getting to the happy ending. I mean, there is no credibility or intellectual sophistication. I like the happy ending. And I think that because the two central characters, Darcy and Elizabeth in Pride and Prejudice, they're getting together, does feel psychologically accurate in a way that some Victorian novel happy endings or Shakespearean happy endings, for example, just aren't. They're not psychologically plausible. They're just tying up of plot ends for the sake of finishing.
Yeah. And what, I mean, Austen loved quite trashy novels. You know, she loved a rollicking good read. So she knew exactly what a reader required. And there's a tempo about her novels. There's always something going forward in them, isn't there? There are not longueurs.
No.
Although perhaps nothing much happens in dramatic terms, you know, girl meets boy, girl gets boy. But it's not, she knows exactly when to put in these stimuli in the plot. And yeah. So you're guaranteed a good read. But then, of course, you've got all the stuff that's Jane Austen on top of that or underneath it. I mean, there's an enormous freight of her own feelings and ideas and personality. And this person who was not a published author until quite late in her life. And I feel, as a biographer, it's a very powerful thread.
Well, could you explain that for us? Because I think that is interesting, because the novel, she publishes Sense and Sensibility in 1811, and then she dies in 1818 with two novels as yet unpublished. Is that right? 1817, sorry. Yeah. 1870, of course.
Well, let's do it all next year.
Let's do it next year in 1870. But then the novels are published in 1818, aren't they? Yes. Northanger and Persuasion. So was she labouring under the idea that a lot of her stuff would never be published?
I believe so, yes, because, I mean, she was writing early versions of Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice and many of the other books from the early 1790s onwards. So she was basically, she'd been an unpublished author for almost 20 years before her first book came out. You know, and she was in her 30s. She must have felt pretty bitter, actually, about the fact that she knew she was a genius, clearly. I mean, she and her very intimate circle were the only readers of Jane Austen, who now has millions and millions of readers.
And she was reading, and she read it out, didn't she? There's a sense that she may have read these books out to her circle as she was writing them.
Yes, because Martha Lloyd was... Jane made a joke about her. If she reads it one more time, she'll know it by heart. You know, I mean, actually, some of the close friends and Cassandra knew the works probably very well. But they were just stuck, you know, in that circle, in manuscript. And, you know, she'd had the sale of the book that became Northanger Abbey in 1803. At that point, I mean, she'd waited 10 years at that point, and she must have thought, thank God, I'm now going to get into print.
Presumably that afforded her a certain amount of freedom, though, to develop her style and chop and change.
Yes, oh, certainly. But I think, if you think of being a writer who wants to be published, I mean, the freedom that you gain from being allowed to keep working on your manuscripts year after year is rather outweighed by the disappointment of nobody else reading them. And so I think, you know, it's certainly a two-edged sword, but I think it has a huge number of repercussions for the works. I think it makes them, you know, as I say, very dense with these little interjections that come through in most of the novels. I mean, it's not just irony, it's not pithy, it's not witty, but these kind of actual darts that penetrate the surface of the novel sometimes.
And there's a kind of self-consciousness in part, I mean, not least in Northanger Abbey, which is a parody, but even in Pride and Prejudice and a couple of others, there is all of a sudden the narrator steps to one side and the author seems to speak. There's a consciousness of the medium.
Yes, indeed. I mean, especially, that's brilliant in Northanger Abbey, where she talks about the novel, you know, and suddenly kind of comes forward as the author, having her own opinions. It's brilliant. And it's so outrageously rompingly good fun, that passage too. And then she kind of goes back in, you know, and starts doing her work as a novelist. But then, of course, towards the end of the novel, when she says, you can now see, because of the compression of the pages, that we're all going towards a happy ending, which is a great joke. It's a wonderful, brilliant joke. So she's got control over all that stuff. And I do think that long period of not being published, and you're saying that control was a good thing. I think she did become a really obsessively controlling author. But the good thing was that she knew what a novel should have, she could produce it, and she was a kind of life-loving person, although she didn't particularly love the life that she'd been given, but she was a very optimistically sort of inclined person.
And the Jane Austen and the Austen works that we have, that we think of the six novels, they're very different, aren't they, to the Juvenalia?
Yes, that early genius, I mean, the young girl of, you know, 18 and 19, who was entertaining her own family with First Impressions, which became Pride and Prejudice, and who presumably was very vocal in the family circle. There, of the very few accounts of Jane Austen as a teenager, two of them use the word affected, which is really interesting. And the idea that she was actually quite an extrovert, a bit of a show-off, you know, kind of brainy, not massively beautiful, perfectly passable 18-year-old, who was a social critic and who was, a wit and a delineator of character. And you get a feeling of this energy, I mean, massive energy. The Juvenilia is full of confidence and, really good jokes, but they're worldly jokes. They're very worldly works. And then, of course, you become somebody who seems much more contained in the published novels.
And is there a large process of editing? So something like First Impressions, which became Pride and Prejudice, are we able to chart what it first looked like and then the process of sort of chiselling it down to what it eventually became?
No, if only. Wouldn't it be nice if up a chimney in Chawton somebody found the manuscript, because the manuscripts have all been lost apart from little bits of Persuasion, because printers typically just got rid of manuscripts once the book was in print, so we don't know. But from Austen's letters, we do know that these things were being worked on a lot. And then when Pride and Prejudice, for instance, was about to be published, she talks about the kind of final edit, this lopping and cropping. And as with Sense and Sensibility, a worry that she doesn't quite know what she's left with. She's worked on these books so long that she doesn't entirely, you know, the continuity problems. She doesn't entirely remember who did what.
Oh, really?
She's got to change the money values. She says to Cassandra she's got to change incomes in Sense and Sensibility, because it's an old story.
Yeah.
I mean, Sensibility itself was a bit of a passé concept in 1811. I mean, it was a 1790s subject. There were 1790s girls. And the fact that she was writing about her own youth right up to her death means that a character like Emma, who's meant to be like 19 or something, is the fogiest, or 20, the fogiest 20-year-old you could possibly imagine. And it's completely reasonable that she and Mr. Knightley get off with each other, because they are of a piece. I mean, they seem to be very much in the same generation, because Austen is remembering what it's like to be a girl, you know, back.
And presumably Anne Elliot in Persuasion's 27, isn't she?
Yes, over the hill.
But kind of, you can sense it written by a slightly older woman and who admires her but recognises that she's looking back on a life where she's made decisions which may or may not have turned out correctly.
Completely. And Eleanor Dashwood is a total sort of old school 19-year-old. I mean, she's so sensible. She's like a much older person. I thought it was interesting that in the Ang Lee film, Emma Thompson cast herself as Eleanor. And Emma Thompson was the age that Mrs. Dashwood should have been, really, when she made that film. But it recognised a sort of maturity, an unreasonable maturity in Eleanor, the character, you know, that needs to be represented.
Which is there in Emma as well, isn't Emma sort of being this person who wants to be controlling and directing, as if she were a middle-aged woman.
Yeah, she behaves like a matron, doesn't she?
Really? Yeah. You contrast with Fanny and Isabella, of course, in Northanger Abbey, who are sort of these brilliant studies of the silly seriousness of teenagerdom.
Oh, they're charming. Yeah. I love Northanger Abbey for that reason, and Catherine is just so much like a young woman.
Catherine. Yeah,
and they are, but that is the book that she was worried about in 1803 being out of date. That was also, it was not published in her lifetime, and the little preface she wrote for its publication apologises massively for it being a book that is, you know, perhaps out of date, over the hill. But I think it's one of the freshest versions.
I'm glad you say that, Claire, because I want to ask. So in my little intro to the paper this week, and I've done this on social media and I'm getting bombarded with abuse now. Interesting you say about Persuasion. A journalist just sent me a message saying how Persuasion, she read at a boarding school at 16 and felt every sort of palpitation of Anne Elliot's heart, which is interesting. So anyway, I did it in my order, my six in order. And I want you to say what you think, Claire, and Theo as well. So I go Pride and Prejudice, Persuasion, Sense and Sensibility, Emma, Mansfield Park, and Bringing Up the Rear, Northanger Abbey.
Mm.
Give me the correct version.
Yeah. No, my version is Persuasion, Pride and Prejudice, Emma, Sense and Sensibility, Northanger Abbey, Mansfield Park.
We're not that far apart.
That's quite different.
Go on.
I think Pride and Prejudice is sort of tied with Mansfield Park for me. I think Pride and Prejudice is better and I probably enjoyed more, but Mansfield Park was the first one that I studied. So I felt more in it.
Yes.
followed by Persuasion, I think, and then Northanger Abbey, and then Emma, and then Sense and Sensibility.
Mm. Isn't it interesting that Persuasion seems to me to be the aficionados, when you talk to Austenites, Jainites, has it become almost the sophisticated answer, Persuasion?
Possibly, yes.
Maybe. Why is that? Because it's mature?
Yeah, because it's autumnal, it's demographic thing too.
But was she at the peak of her powers? Because that presumably wasn't endlessly rewritten, that was written and then published.
Exactly, yeah, because there's just a few. Mansfield Park was kind of written and published, so Mansfield Park's a very interesting book to look at in terms of Austen writing in the moment rather than doing this kind of, you know, catching up with her old manuscripts. And Persuasion was very much of that, of her last year or so. And she had revised it. It's not clear whether she thought it was absolutely good to go at her death in 1817, but yes, it was a very recent book, and it's about, you know, autumnal longing, and it resolves everything so beautifully. I just love the restoration. I think it's the most Shakespearean of her plots. It's just got such a lovely, mellow fruitfulness to it as well.
Yeah, and I think the way that the initial decision to separate and then it comes back again with everyone older and wiser is very...
It's very realistic as well, isn't it?
Realistic.
That having to be in a room where your ex comes in and who's done well or not, you don't really know because you're just totally out of touch with them. It's very well
observed. I think Emma doesn't linger as well because Emma, to me, is an unattractive character. Mm. And the whole plot machinations that then follow her and the unattractiveness of her character actually make it quite hard to feel entirely engaged all the way through. I don't know if that's, again, reading at a particularly unsophisticated level, but there's not so much to sort of hug close to you in Emma. I think she's quite an annoying character in some respects.
Well, when people do talk about Austen, it's always in terms of the relatability of the characters and whether you like them or you don't, and that would be true for me with Emma, yeah.
Well, are there any characters, Claire, you'd like to sort of celebrate or excoriate? Who's the person you dislike the most in Austen fiction?
I think it's much easier to find out ones to dislike than love. I mean, she's full of it's a great crowd of fools, but they're not usually so foolish that you dismiss them. They are just normally awful.
Yeah.
And that's her brilliance, isn't it? That she can pick these characteristics out. I mean, I think Fanny Dashwood is absolutely a terrible, terrible woman. I mean, there she is having hysterics off camera, because we don't see this, over the fact that she hears that Edward is engaged to Lucy Steele. You know, Eleanor's just heard that, and of course it's far more important to Eleanor.
Yeah.
But the whole household on Harley Street has to grind to a halt because Fanny is having hysterics. And the scene, that early scene in Sense and Sensibility, where she is talking her husband down from giving the half-sisters a proper income to almost nothing, it's brilliant, but it's incredibly nasty.
I think the lack of self-awareness of some of the characters, and there's a lot in Pride and Prejudice, actually, but Lydia Bennet... Lydia Bennet, when you've romped all the way through it and Darcy comes and saves the day and she's with the idiot Wickham, and she comes back home and the dad finally lets her in, having said he's not going to let her in, and then she insists on walking ahead because she's the married one.
Yes,
and
her, yes, that's
and
right.
These sisters have spent the last sort of month panicking and thinking their whole life is over and their reputation is soiled, and then she says, and then her mum is so delighted that she got married at all. That I find Lydia Bennet the person that I would most like to sort of walk away from.
Exactly.
I was talking to Stig about Diana Parker in Sanditon. Yes. I think she's such a great character because there's something... She's unlikable because she's just ridiculous and annoying with her affectations and her fads, her kind of, you know, green tea. She's very relatable to... You can place her in the present moment, you know, with her weird food foibles and her desire to go bathing in the sea, but only with one of the newfangled, what they call bathing machines, these portable things.
Love a bathing
machine. There's just something very, very now about her, very kind of clean eating.
Yes.
What do we make of Sanditon, Claire? If she'd have lived, where would that have appeared in the pantheon?
I think it's the most fascinating book. I love Sanditon. Obviously not for the plot, because it stops. but it is so, so interesting. It's the unpolished, it's the unrevised Jane Austen, and it's got some very, very painful scenes in. The scene where Charlotte, the heroine, who again is one of these rather foggyish young women, is sitting having to listen to Lady Denham drone on about stuff. She actually decides that she's not going to listen. It's like Homer Simpson going, you know, not listening. And so she it's so intolerable. I mean, she listens to Lady Denham for a bit, and then the conversation takes such a bad turn. She's so unpleasant that Charlotte just has to... She can't say anything because it's not allowed. So she has to retire into silence and just think over the noise. And she knows that Lady Denham's still talking. And then Austin does this amazing paragraph full of Charlotte's actual thoughts, which are these kind of disjointed stream of consciousness thoughts. Ah. And it's the most incredible scene. And whether Austin would have left it like that had she finished a draft and then gone back and rewritten it. I mean, she might have recalculated that scene and gone into the third person. Who knows? Because Austin's amazing at this point of view thing. I mean, she just kind of zooms around like one of those cameras, you know, like a drone, really, yeah, basically, or something at the US Open, comes right down and looks at the character and then zooms away. And sometimes you get this first-person pronoun, as you do bursting through in Northanger Abbey. I noticed one in Sense and Sensibility, which I was rereading the other week. It's about halfway through volume two, and suddenly you get this I am now going to... You think, hang on, who are you?
Who's the I? Yeah.
Who are you? And where have you gone? I mean, it pops up and then it goes. But she does kind of inhabit scenes, and she looks at the Dashwoods, you know, as if she's a fly on the wall.
You can see why Virginia Woolf and Catherine Mansfield would have been so
completely
absorbed by
it. It's a brilliant technique. But I mean, nobody had done this before. I mean, I can't think of any of the 18th century novelists that she adored who just move around like that, and who then kind of hover behind the heroine. I mean, she...
Yeah, the free and direct style, in a way. I mean, yeah. When you read about it, it's the sort you see developed over the course... Does it become more and more perfected, do you think, over the
Completely. I think it's brilliant. But I don't know about whether she would have done more to Sanditon to kind of take away from this extraordinary... I mean, she might have polished it into... Because I do think that her novels hang together as a group because she did do all this polishing. She did deliberately try to make them look like a coherent group of six novels, and they're not really. The heroines aren't like each other at all, and nothing about them, if you put them all anonymously out there, would necessarily connect them.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Let's talk about the afterlife of Jane Austen, because she wrote a very good book called Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World. I mean, I don't want you to summarise your entire book, but how did she do that and why? And I suppose when was the moment that Jane Austen went from being a novelist of interest to people to being a dominant cultural figure?
Yes, well, that's a very good question. I don't know that I could answer it very easily, but when I was thinking about writing that book, and I started to notice where Austenishness was all around one every day. It was just astonishing. You know, kind of tune into it, and it's absolutely in the most unusual places, you know, including around the back of a football goal, of an advert for electronics. There was a conference that was talking about extreme pornography that was, you know, quoting from Emma, all sorts of different things. You know, Dick Cheney was talking about Jane Austen, just... Almost every area of life you could get an Austen reference in, and people, of course, love the first sentence of Pride and Prejudice. Journalists love it. Ugh. And they
We have a rule here, actually. Michael, who's not here, I did an introduction to this book, and I deliberately wrote a pastiche of the first sentence just to annoy Michael, because he gets a lot of pieces about Austen in, and the number of reviewers who start with It's a Truth University.
I know.
Acknowledged, but it's sort of, is it almost Shakespearean? I mean, there's maybe Dickens, maybe, but I think less so with Dickens. I'm not sure Dickens pervades the consciousness in the
way. Exactly, because Dickens, we have Dickensianness, which is very recognisable. But Austen, I think it really took off actually after the 1995 films on TV. But it had been, obviously she was very, very popular from the late 1870s onwards. I mean, after the first biography, which augmented the novels, which weren't that very well known during the 19th century. Really? Generally, they were out of print for a decade or so after her death, and she slowly got some critical notice during the 19th century, but really she was treated as a passé Georgian novelist.
So the great Victorian novelists don't owe a debt to her, really?
Not really, because not that many of them had read her. And people like Charlotte Bronte, who very much objected to G.H. Lewis's advocacy of Jane Austen, read her to catch up with this stuff, but she'd already objected to Austen on principle, and she didn't like the so actually Austen's legacy was strangely, you know, end stopped at that point.
Yeah.
And it really got much more activated around the whole idea of her life and how charming a person she'd been and how unobjectionable. And the novels, of course, then became, you know, there was the cult of Divine Jane. That was a late Victorian cult. Again, you know, rather fastidious people trying to characterise themselves culturally through Jane Austen. They saw her as somebody who represented gentility.
Virtue signalling. We're talking about Victorian virtue signalling.
Exactly. What a wonderful phrase that is. Where was it in the 1890s? But that's exactly what they were doing. They were virtue signalling. And people still do that, obviously.
Yeah, indeed.
And then she was one of the first English authors to be treated to scholarly editing in the, you know, early days of the 20th century.
That in itself was quite an interesting time, wasn't it? Because in the sort of 1920s, there was the Chapman kind of scholarly authoritative version asking people to go back and realise how important and accomplished these works were. At the same time as I think the Austen family were still in charge, yes, of her literary legacy, and they were sort of commercialising and pushing a different version of Austen. So yes, you had this bifurcation of...
Yes, you did.
Legacy.
And also when the letters were published, because it was a matter of dissent, that when her letters were published, people thought that was actually very inappropriate to publish the letters of a woman who clearly had not intended any of those things to be read. You know, they were thought of as very personal documents. Also things like the Watson, the Sanditon, the Juvenilia. And the family did start to publish these works and were criticised for it in many ways. But of course, if they'd destroyed them, that would have been terrible. But then the scholarly work on Austen was part of her being an easy cannon fodder. I mean, like, yeah, you know, a literary cannon fodder. The discipline of English literature was just starting up.
Did Leavis like her? I'm sure. I can't remember. I'm sure he probably did. Is she in the canon of the Leavis canon?
You know, I can't remember.
No, she's very studied. I mean, the thing that I remember doing at university, because she wrote six novels,
yes,
which are all easy to read, and she's very studyable, isn't she? She's absolutely, yes, opens up to studying, because they're sophisticated, there's lots going on, but equally, exactly, they're easy to read, and you can... It's quite hard to read all of Dickens.
Yes.
It's very hard to read all of James.
Yes.
Quite hard to read all of Eliot. Austen, you can kind of compartmentalise and say, I'll just read the six novels, and then you've read... Yeah. Is there a single major author that you can do that with other than Austen? Maybe not.
Not really, no. Well, I suppose the Brontes didn't write very many books.
No.
But, yeah, Austen's...
It doesn't feel as complete, does it? The oeuvre feels kind of complete for Austen, isn't it?
Yes, because I think she was doing this sort of major controlling exercise on them, and they are extremely lovable as well as readable. And they're very translatable. I mean, the simplicity of the language means that they can also, you know, they travelled quite far.
Oh, is she big in other parts of the world?
She was translated into French very early on. I mean, sort of pirated into French. And she was in English, pirated in America. And then she had these strange, you know, like James Fenimore Cooper basically nicked parts of Austen to write his own novel, Precaution. Yeah. In 1821.
No one would spot that.
It's not very exciting, does it?
No, it wasn't very exciting. I'm glad we got on to the Mohawks.
Yeah. Who did she influence then? I want to finish on adaptations, but who did, you know, who read Jane Austen? Who do you see as the sort of the heirs to Austen? Who did she influence?
Well, Catherine Mansfield and Virginia Woolf very much so, I think, because and also Woolf's writing on Austen is very astute.
It's lovely, We have a big piece in the book we've got.
Yes, it's a wonderful essay, and so many of Woolf's essays absolutely nail something about a writer in a writerly way. I mean, she writes both critically and as a novelist, and so she appreciates all the sort of levels of skill and craft that go into the Austen works. And also this creation of character, the keeping of people in play, which is, you know, very much is what people would love to be able to write. But I think the trouble with Austen is that people try to emulate the wittiness, yeah, and it just falls horribly short. As with the very famous first sentence of Pride and Prejudice, it just sounds so tinny, doesn't it, after a while?
It does.
And yet the manner of it, the manner that she herself is lampooning,
exactly right, yeah,
is what also persists along with appreciation of the lampoon. I mean, she's meant to be our big ironist, isn't she? She's meant to be the person who taught us that we are ironic as a nation and that we can glory in this, and it's a great part of our culture and our heritage in literature. And yet you have things like the £10 note that's just coming out with, as many, many people have pointed out, an absurd quotation on it.
From Caroline Bingley.
From Caroline Bingley, who...
Terrible
before
character
she,
again.
Before
awful
she
person.
Says that, terrible, wonderfully observed, terrible yeah. character, who just before she says, I declare there's no such pleasure as reading or whatever, has given a great yawn. And yeah. she's interrupted yeah. Darcy and Elizabeth, who are the real readers,
yep.
and she's borrowed the second volume to thwart him. So she's completely...
She's reading upside down almost,
yes,
isn't she?
Yes, exactly. It is the most ill-chosen quote. Yeah. And yet the Bank of England, having had this pointed out to them, they decided that didn't matter, actually. Didn't you think, matter. Hang on, and yet this woman is being celebrated for her irony.
Well, there's an irony in
it
all
is.
Of this.
Indeed.
I thought Patrick O'Brien, I mean, I'm just reading Patrick O'Brien, who's the sort of naval historical fiction.
That's true.
He loves Jane Austen,
yes.
and it's the same period. And you can just, I mean, it's very different because it's sort of slightly swashbuckling historical fiction, but there's something of the pervading irony through
Ian
it.
Ian Forster was a great admirer of yeah. Jane Austen. I think there's quite a lot of her in him.
Adaptations. You say that when you're feeling low, you turn to an adaptation. We have in the paper this week, inexplicably, we didn't review Clueless when it came out, the right. Alicia Silverstone version of yes. Emma set in an LA high school. So we've asked someone to review it again for it. Because to me, that's I very clearly remember the BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice,
yes.
the TV one with the famous Darcy wet t-shirt competition
yes,
when he comes
indeed.
Out of the lake. Who's it played by?
Colin Firth.
Colin Firth.
Who is it
you
played by?
Yes, yes.
But you remember him emerging glistening from the lake?
Yes, I do.
And that was, yeah exactly. Quite right too. So I'm going to say Clueless. What do you think? What do you turn to when you want to watch a bit of Austen? Who's done it well?
Well, Colin in the lake has done it well, but of course it's not Austen. That's a scene that they put in.
I know, yeah, indeed, yeah.
So that's the least Austenian piece of TV. I enjoyed Clueless when I first saw it, but I can't say it kind of has gripped me ever since. I really liked a biopic, weirdly enough, called Miss Austen Regrets. It was on television about 10 years ago. And it had Olivia Williams in it. And what I liked about it was that the script was very closely based on Austen's letters, which are themselves one of my favourite texts. I love her letters, and I read those more often than I read the novels.
Really, really.
And I think the letters repay endless attention, especially if you just take them one at a time. Don't just read them as a block, but read them as actual sort of individual letters. And the scriptwriter of that biopic picked up on a lot of little things from the letters, which actually mainstream biographers haven't quite assimilated into the Austen story. So, you know, the fact that she was drinking quite a bit at one point, and there's a kind of slightly woozy scene in that when she's possibly speaking a little bit out of turn to
That's
Charles Hayden, the doctor.
That's interesting. Also because there has been a gin brand sort of launched on the back of Jane right. Austen, so that makes it seem somehow more relevant,
yes.
I suppose. But I was unaware
gin
of that.
Brand, that's
there
fantastic.
We had it in the paper in January, didn't we?
Yeah.
Have you seen any good or bad?
Well, I would obviously say yes, Clueless, and I'm going to now lower the tone massively.
God,
and it's not because
is that possible to go
yes.
further? Go on.
Oh no, I'm going to go lower.
Go on.
So this isn't because I'm saying it's the most important adaptation or particularly very good, but it's what made me interested in Jane Austen when I was about 10, and it was a programme put out by PBS in America called Wishbone. Mm-hmm. And it was the main character was a Jack Russell. He lived in Texas. And he used to trot back through time and take on the roles of leading characters in the classics of Western fiction. And so there was an episode called
No one saw this coming.
First Impressions, as in fur. first impressions.
The original title,
and
Pride
played,
and Prejudice.
Yes, exactly. And he played Darcy. And actually, as far as kids' telly goes, and I don't watch any now, obviously, because I'm an adult,
yeah,
it was very good. Well, yes, but you have a reason to.
Yeah, I do. I do.
So just to be absolutely clear, this uses the original title of Pride and Prejudice,
yes,
and tells the story of Pride and Prejudice through a Texan dog.
Yeah, a Texan talking Jack Russell.
Have you not seen this? You call yourself an Austin scholar, I don't know how I missed that one.
Yeah. This
guy, Wishbone.
Wishbone.
Mate, I'm going to check
Wishbone.
That out.
I think the tagline was something like a small dog with a massive literary imagination or something.
Big vocabulary.
Something catchier than that.
It's a truth university. Any horrors that you've seen? Did you ever?
I didn't see the zombie film.
I started watching that. It's not quite as bad as you think it's going to be. There's a little bit of archness that knows what it's doing.
Yes,
but it
would need an awful lot of archness.
Yeah,
to
it wasn't quite.
But I did speak to the Jane Austen Society of North America in the week that film came out, and a lot of them had seen it and they loved it.
Yeah,
I thought they'd be down on it like a ton of bricks, but actually not. And but I did see the book, the Seth Graham Brown's book.
Oh yeah,
And I thought it was amazing as a phenomenon that you can take 85% of Austen's book, put 15% of Ultraviolet Zombie Mayhem of your own into it, and come up with a book that sells millions of copies, much more than Pride and Prejudice,
really,
in any given period. I mean, yes, absolutely millions.
Did that make you angry?
No, it didn't make me angry because I don't feel I kind of, have to stand
fight.
Up for the... Yeah. But it is astonishing that less Austen goes further. I mean, I think in terms of her fame and her recognisability, which is what Margaret Oliphant pinned down in the 1870s, that Austen had this ability, to push people's buttons. They didn't have to have read her books, but that she was a recognisable cultural figure. And that, I think, the Seth Graham Brown phenomenon displays that perfectly. You know, you can have a bit less Austen goes even further.
Oh dear, on that note.
Yeah,
it's a slightly depressing note. Claire, thank you so much for coming in to discuss all things Austen. The paper this week is a celebration of Jane Austen, and we have this book as well, which contains essays by E.M. Forster and Virginia Woolf. Do go to the-tls.co.uk to see this week's edition of the paper, which, amid all of this ostentation, also contains Benjamin Markovitz on the history of cool and Helen Morales on the classical history of disgust. And tweet this podcast at FBFM_podcast with your comments and thoughts. Please do review us on iTunes. Next week, we're going to be musing upon that strange, orange and often absentee President of the United States, as we are publishing a piece by Edward Luttwak that, gulp, predicts a Trump dynasty in power for the next 16 years. Yes, you may well both look depressed. And that's what we'll be talking about. So to cheer us up, this is a fantastic farm by Matt, our producer. He has discovered online, of course, Thea. It's Wishbone.
Wishbone the talking dog.
Wishbone the talking dog doing first impressions. His version of Pride and Prejudice, seen once by a young Thea Leonarduzzi in 1992. So to play us out, you're going to want to listen to this. Here it is, Wishbone the Talking Dog.
It is your turn to speak, Mr. Darcy. I talk to the dance, and you ought to make some kind of remark about the size of the room. Or the number of couples.
Your sister will dance with just about anybody, huh?
I guess you prefer to criticise everyone. I have heard all about you.
Well, don't believe everything you hear.
That's the genuine dialogue, isn't it?
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. And that's a genuine jacket as well.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.